Hey, Brain Drain. Nice to meet you. How are you doing?
How you doing, Wrong Nebula? Is that what you'd like to go by as well, Wrong Nebula?
Yeah, yeah. That's how people know me in the space.
Excellent. I love that. Well, thanks for having me on the chat.
We're here in New York, not far from kind of like where you grew up as well.
This is where I spent a lot of my formative years. I would say I grew up in New York. I was born and raised here, and I grew up between Long Island and Manhattan. Once my parents split, my dad moved back to the city, and that's when I started spending all my teen years here around near the Village and around Astor Place, and, you know, a little bit of Chinatown. Mostly a downtown person. I usually didn't go above 14th Street, and it was from there all the way down into Chinatown, mostly eating, mostly video games. Interesting.
Yeah, you showed me before, like this. There's this video game store that has like everything.
Yeah, Video Games New York, a little shout out for them, but they've been around for years, and it's a place where you can just go and stare at your past if you're a video gamer, you know, because they have everything that you can remember from your past. Mm-hmm. So I would spend weekends either trolling around St. Mark's in Chinatown for really interesting comic books and looking for really old games to add to my collection, because I used to collect a lot of Super Nintendo games and a lot of old Atari games, which you saw just a second ago, are filling the walls in that space. So that's a very special space to me, for sure. And it's also great to be able to show someone that's just in New York for the first time these places, because they still have their magic. I've been here for so long, I see them, you know, they're like old friends, but to see you get a little excited about it is nice.
And so you used to work in the video game industry, right?
Yeah, so I was one of, at the time, the youngest employees at Rockstar Games in New York.
Cool.
I wound up going to college for computer animation and game content creation because I wanted to get into games, but I wasn't a coder. I wasn't a math guy when I was in school. So I was like, I have to contribute somehow. I'm going to have to create, I want to create worlds. I want to, you know, express myself through a more visual medium. Anyway, I'm a more visual person. So I figured, hey, I can get into 3D. I can maybe start building these 3D worlds for games, and it would be a good step in the, like, you know, get my foot in the door. And, you know, and I would have done anything. I would have done level design. I would have done easy modeling work. You know, there was a dream at one point that maybe I would do, you know, you would think you're going to go work at Pixar when you're in college. You think you're going to go work at ILM, but
I think Rockstar is already set the bar really high.
It was an absolute blessing to be that young and to be able to cut my teeth with a bunch of pros that just ripped into me. I mean, this was like boot camp beyond boot camp.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a different time in games, of course, too. So it was a bit more of a boys club there. But this is really where I learned a lot about, like, polish and about intentional game design and like, game development and what quality could look like if organized appropriately. And I'm not saying that their organization is, like, tip-top, but if the creative direction has integrity and that creative vision is shared with the team, they can make something really coherent. And probably, like you've seen, if you've played any of their games, some of the most well-realized worlds you'll see in games.
Yeah.
Not to turn this into a... you know, an advertisement for Rockstar, but
they're a great team. Right?
Yeah, they are fantastic.
We need like games like that everyone plays. It's like iconic at this point.
It's a pretty strong pedigree in the industry, and like I said, because of that, I was able to leave some really great friends there, meet some really great friends, and eventually work on some of the bigger games. Like for me, Red Dead Redemption was my like first lead title there, and Red Dead Redemption has a special place in my heart because of that. That was where I did most of my traveling.
Yeah,
I was working abroad for that one. I did all the I did a lot of the mocap for that game, and also for Max Payne 3. And then that was the last game that I did for Rockstar before I moved to Avalanche, which is actually where I met a lot of the our current friends.
Oh,
in the
cool!
World
so you kind of like transition
naturally. It's funny. We're just a bit north from where Rockstar and Avalanche are, but they are rivaling on the border of Broadway.
Yeah.
And Avalanche is the AAA game dev studio that used to be in Soho, and Rockstar, right across the street in NoHo, was the only other AAA game development studio. Rockstar really, in New York, does mostly post, so they're doing QA, they're doing video editing, they're doing motion capture, they're doing the trailers, they're doing the marketing. It's like the brain of the company. All of the development is out in Europe. Avalanche was a true game developer. The whole game was being made
in Soho,
which is incredible, because in New York, we don't have that. It's very expensive to make games here. You don't get a lot of tax benefits from the city. They haven't caught up yet.
Yeah.
We've been fighting for that for years. But it was an amazing transition from Rockstar, because I was hungry to actually make games. I was working in, by the time I left Rockstar, I was working as a QA lead. And you may hear QA as one of the best entryways into game development. As a young game developer, this was exactly that for me. And after leading these large projects at Rockstar, I was able to become the QA manager at Avalanche, and then from there, production, and yada, yada, yada. It kind of moved me further, closer and closer to my creative goals. But it just took extra time, you know? You think you're going to come into the industry and immediately get what you want. I remember sitting with, like, almost a mentor-level person, one of the big dogs at Rockstar, showing them my demo reel as a 19-year-old kid, being like, here's what I got. And he was very nicely, this is the nicest way to let someone down, is it is really great to know that we have someone here with your skills in case we need them. And that was just the way that he let me down as a 19-year-old kid. And I'll always remember that because it didn't completely crush me. It just, it gave me hope. It gave me the realization that there are people here that were willing to, like, kind of view what I have to offer. And they didn't fire, you know, I'm not being fired because they know I don't want to work in QA and I want to move to 3D. They're just like, hey, it's a young, passionate kid. So, you know, I got knocked around a little bit back then, but that also, again, gave me the strength and the strong legs to make it through the industry. And then, yeah, I had the opportunity to go to Avalanche, which was, again, it was a full AAA game studio. Got to move into production, met a lot of great, more great friends, expanded the network. And we really made a close-knit group of game developer friends there. We specifically started, I mean, So at night at Rockstar, and through most of my life, I've also been working indie games, and that's where a lot of the pixel art comes in. And I've been doing pixel art since I was a kid. Me and my partner at my other indie game company, Attack Mountain, he's been my best friend since I was born, actually. And we used to take Kirby games and Mario games, pull their sprite sheets off the internet, rebuild their sprites, and try to recreate a Kirby game. And we were doing this when we were, like, in kindergarten, first grade. We would sit on the floor, we're, like, drawing on paper the levels.
And what are we going to make?
You know, yeah, exactly. And you know, like you were saying earlier, when the game development tools and shareware and freeware became really big in PC back in the 90s, we got a hold of these early game engines, which was like Click and Play by the Click team that eventually turned into Games Factory. These allowed us to use sprites and get used to 2D animation while we played 3D games, right? So we were moving into N64 while we're making Nintendo type games at home, right? So, I'm sorry, I'm going on a tangent here because I need to give you the parallels of, like, the indie and the AAA, because
interesting also where the pixel art came from.
Yeah, because that's actually where the pixel art came from. All this video game stuff is great, and it teaches you how to make the game and how to do the production, but I really learned my artistry from doing it at home, breaking apart games that I loved as a kid, and trying to reverse engineer them, try to recreate them myself, and then eventually teaching myself 2D animation through that, through, like, oh, how do I make Mario run? What pixels are really moving to make his hands look like they're moving? Because it's very little motions in the pixel. And it one pixel movement makes an entirely different look
into
to
an art form.
To the animation. So Avalanche wasn't like Rockstar. Rockstar would not allow me to make my own games. It was a conflict of interest. I don't understand how a AAA game studio that makes the best open world games would look at a child making a Mario rip and go, you're a competition. But it was generally like, I think it was more that we don't want you spending any of your extra calories
In terms of, like, your time and, like, brain energy, they want people to be like 100% focused.
100%. I think that's ultimately what it was. Avalanche was way more flux. If anything, they really enjoyed the fact that we were creative off hours. And so we started doing Kickstarters, and we founded a company. So basically, once I started Avalanche, I also formed an LLC to make my own games and not make games, you know.
So Attack Mountain.
So Attack Mountain has been around for 13 years, and we've released 4 games on Steam. They're all pixel-based. They're all 2D. It's all artwork that I've made and my partner has made and animated, and it's really only been the two of us. And this is pure garage indie game. Back before the indie revolution, before Xbox Live Arcade made indies huge, when Castle Crashers came out and Limbo came out and Fez came out and or Braid, like when all of those indie darlings came out, that was the first time that people were like, oh, you can make blockbuster money off of an indie. And it was the first time where an artist like myself went, holy shit, the games that we've been making, we can actually make for real and, like, make money and get a publisher and get a have a distribution platform, and Steam became a distribution platform for us. So we were like, oh, okay, look, we're definitely going to do this. What they don't tell you is that an indie game, when you make it with two people, could take up to 5 years, and it did. The first one that we didn't decide to make one game. We decided to make a bundle of three games. Three different genres, three different stories, three different art styles. Don't do that, kids at home, if that's your first game. This is not what I recommend if you want to succeed. It is painful enough to complete and realize a polished product. We did three, and it took us 4.5 years, and by the time we were done, the indie revolution had already begun and ended. And people were releasing, 30,000 indies were being released every year on Steam by the time we got our indie out. And by that time, you're just one of the million out there. Now, whether or not that was, like, demoralizing, it still left us with a high degree of skill in working pixel art and game design.
Like a test of fire, you know, like trial by fire.
It's exactly that. And what you find yourself is, even if you release a game and it's not a smash hit, we still had this urge to create another world. We still had this urge to create more characters.
And you make contacts in the space.
Exactly. And we started doing a lot more playcrafting events, and we did one of the first indie conventions in New York, and we were one of we were chosen as one of the best indies there for the current game. So all these things feel really good. They validate your process. They validate your path. But ultimately, you know, indie games, it's a really tough biz, and you can't just expect that you're going to knock out of the park immediately, and, you know, there's a lot of competition out there. But luckily for me, that wasn't the only way that I was making money. In fact, I wasn't making any money that way, because I had a AAA job that allowed me to understand larger systems and gameplay programming and Unreal and the use of, like, larger engines and 3D spaces. And this is when game development becomes even more compelling, right?
Yeah.
Because you can take the things that you've learned from indie or that you've learned from retro games, and you can apply them to a 3D space and create new worlds or subvert expectations of the player innovate. You know?
I feel like with 2D games and, like, pixel art and, like, indie games, there's, like, the limitations not only of the engines but also of the size of the team makes you focus even more on the gameplay.
Exactly, because you're rapidly developing, you're prototyping your ideas the minute you have them. You don't have anybody going, does this fit the vision of the project? You don't have a lead designer that's in there in a paper document only trying to design around your idea. No, boom, rapid prototype, get it in, play it. Does it feel good? No. Scrap it, you know, iterate. Rapid iteration is key.
And how did Web3 and, like, crypto came into that? How did you discover the space?
This is a great transition, because now I've been spending all this time trying to make compelling worlds in 3D and in 2D and for games and for gamers, and to, like, this has been the passion for us and you know, for a lot of the people that you may hear on your interview series. We're all from the same world, you know. A lot of us, we work the same companies together. You have some ex-Rockstars, you have some other ex-Avalanchers floating around in Web3 and Blipmap and Chainrunners, you know? And in this New York crew that we have, we've been able to kind of build a strong foundation of what each of us provide individually and how we, you know, it feels really good to have a team. It feels really good to have a team in New York, in a city where it's usually a big old rat race and people are trying to step on each other. But no, we came up together in games, which is really tough in New York as it is. We run in these streets together. We hang out together for years and years and years. And we're always helping support one another and kind of augmenting our skills to, like, hey, you know a saxophonist? I need a saxophonist for a track and a video game that I'm working on. And we wind up collaborating whether we want to or not. And it's led us to this point where, when the pandemic happened, we were at Avalanche Studios at this time. And by we, I mean myself, Varley, Totally, and various other faces and characters that you may know from at least the Blipmap scene. And we're all big gamers and game developers, and this is really where our passions lied at that time. We were just trying to make an industry and help each other get to the top, you know, enjoying the GDCs and the E3s and game launches. And we really, really missed being in the office with each other. You know, you get really used to collaborating closely in a creative space, like a game, like, you know, you wake up, you have a nice team meeting, you can do a stand-up, you kick it off, you go to the, 2 hours later, you get to walk around the office, you get to look over everyone's shoulders, how is their progress going, your reanimators are over here, your modelers, your programmers, and you can feel the energy. There's an energy exchange that was occurring when you're in a physical space being creative. Now, of course, things are different. We've had to learn how to change that a bit. But when that first hit us, and we all had to go home. I mean, we were at the office one day, and it was just like the next day we were not at the office anymore.
Yeah.
And I know this is probably something that you've heard from a lot of people,
but
we didn't know that we were never going to come back. It was just like, hey, this is happening right now. We kind of have to go. And we all just got up and kind of left all our shit at the office. And that was it. And you know, the first week passes by and we're like, this is sick. Let's meet up at a bar. Like, we have all the time in the world. We got to work from home. Like, this pandemic, who knows about a pandemic, you know, whatever. And that was what, March, early March, like before the shit hit the fan. Then it was like week two. We're still not back in the office. Then it was like month two. And it was like, oh, I guess we're not going back to the office because, like, I guess it's just going to be another month then. Like, maybe we'll come back. And they're like, yeah, you know, we're going to think maybe in another month we're going to come back. So, you know, your life is on hold and you're changing your plans. You think, hey, we're going to be back and we're going to... Cut to 6 months later, we're still not back to the office. We now have settled into the fact that, okay, life is going to be a little different. The way that we create things together has to be different. The way that we interact with each other is going to have to change. And we're going to have to evolve together like we've evolved before. Or we're going to have to do it quick because we're getting depressed. And depression kills productivity and it kills creativity. So, Totally and I, Totally had been wanting to, I think Totally was trying to centralize a lot of our power at a time, and him and I were talking about Discord, and I wasn't a Discord user. He had been dabbling in Discord, but him and I, you know, I've been working in indie games, and every time Attack Mountain makes a new game, we're working with, you know, this person from Avalanche to make the music, and this person from Rockstar to do this. And so we have, like, this network of game developers, and we're like, how do we keep this network of game developers together? Because the beauty of having such a tight network that are all friends is that you can always work off of each other, and that's what you have when you're together physically every day.
Yeah.
We started to feel like, hey, we need to bring everybody back together, and Discord is probably a great place for this. So we
and it was using the video game, like, hurt by players already.
Somehow I didn't understand the power that that software has for communication and collaboration until we made this collaborative game developer space. And this collaborative game developer space was meant to, you know, keep us hanging out, drinking after work, making cool games, working on projects, yada, yada, yada. And it did. We probably filled the thing up with, like, over 50, 60 top-ranking, amazingly talented game developers. But you're not thinking about it. You know, these are our friends. They just happen to be skilled game developers. But we just wanted to hang out and have that ability. And we also knew that in a year, if one of us had a project or wanted to start a company, the people are available and they're ready to go. They're just waiting, right? So we were in that Discord working. I was working on my indie games. Sabina was working on his things. This guy's working on that. This guy's working on this. And Totally winds up inviting Dom to our Discord. And they were friends from a previous company. And, you know, all I knew is that he was the creator of Vine. And basically that we shouldn't let many people know that he's the creator of Vine because it would probably poison the water hole of the Discord. You don't necessarily want a bunch of hungry indies to, like, know who everyone is. It's actually quite nice to be anonymous in a space of creatives because it allows you to actually flourish around them without feeling like you're under some sort of, you know, scrutiny or watchful eye or someone wants something from you. So it was a very pure creative space. Dom started making some Infinite Runner. We're hanging out. I'm making, like, a Joust sim, like a Joust clone. And, you know, and that's how we got to know each other first. And it was very whatever. It was very cool, super casual. One day, Dom pops into the Discord and he goes, hey, any pixel artists here want to contribute pixel art? And of course, I go, ding, ding, ding. Not only do I love pixel art, but Dom is quite an interesting character. I should probably submit some artwork to Dom. And I think I wound up sending him the first four Blip maps, which the first couple were actually the foodstuffs one. It was like the din-din, the turkey. It was the mushroom, right? It was...
the eggplant also?
The eggplant, that's right. And then the last one was caffeinate, the cola, well, the classic cola. And these were also really stemmed from, like, old games, like you may have seen them from Ice Climbers or from Pac-Man. Like, you know, the little power-ups that you would get in these old pixel-based games. That was the inspiration behind those first four pieces. Also because I was so deep in game development, 2D game development at the time. One of them actually is a sprite from one of my games.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I just down-resed the colors because we had the color
like
restriction.
Like a little Easter egg.
But exactly. I knew that I wanted to tackle it quick, and I wanted to just deliver it almost the day of the ask because I like to be a high productivity person, and I also know that I'll forget. I also tend to have ADD, so it's like, oh, he wants it. I literally just pivoted my thoughts, made the first four, and then that first four kind of got me into the flow, and, you know, I was allowed to make 11, and I was very happy to make 11 of them, and I got to really expand beyond outside of food. I started doing weird ones. I started doing the Sasquatch. I did, you know, the Cool Cat, because Cool Cat's just a cool vibe character, right? I wanted them, I was approaching Blipmap like I wanted each Blipmap to represent an emotion or a feeling, a little bit of, and this was before we understood the power of the emoji or the memeability of these things. Like I didn't know what we were doing back then. We were just having fun. But what I wanted was a large spectrum of color, and I wanted a large spectrum of emotion and a feeling. Which is why, and there are some lost blitz that never made it, that may have countered some of the emotions that I put out there, but I ultimately had to choose the 11 best.
Yeah.
That I thought were the coolest and also the most varied. So, for example, like Lay Off Me, the elephant, is almost graphical in comparison to something like Communion, which is like an illustrated mantis, yeah. Right? And some of these came from weird, I was into alien conspiracy. Some of them are from video games. Some of them are from my tattoos and from iconography that I really enjoy. Like Illuminate, of course, it also comes from conspiracy. It also comes from really great iconography. The Illuminated Eye has so much history. It's an easy one. And what I knew was the shapes that I was creating in Blipmap were highly recognizable and highly relatable. And that means that people may like them. Yeah. And may want to collect them. Because I want to collect them.
Is there a backstory to the Lay Off Me one with the elephant?
There is actually a little bit of a backstory to the Lay Off Me one. And this will be the first time anyone will hear it, actually. It wasn't Lay Off Me. It didn't say Lay Off Me at first.
Okay.
In fact, the elephant first said... hold on one second. It said... So right now, it doesn't say Lay Off Me, does it?
I think so.
Yeah, it does. And, yeah. and then the alternate, it feels like... So the reason why we like Lay Off Me, because it also kind of reads like Lay Me Off, and it's like a comfortable elephant. But before that, it was kind of like a get... It said something different that was pointing a little bit more of the focus towards like a World Wildlife Federation.
Okay.
Yeah. Where it was like a protect the elephants sort of vibe. And I think we were a little concerned at the time. It was one of the few Blipmap edits that we made. And this was a Dom and me thing. We kind of had a conversation where there was a concern in which maybe it would appear as if we were making a connection between the environmental hazards of the space that we hear being controversial and that maybe I'm making a statement.
Yeah.
And maybe that statement is not a statement that we want to make. So I changed it to something a little bit more... you know, generic, and at least it had that duality of like a lay me off, lay off me, because ultimately none of us really want to work, and one of the magic things about this space is it has the potential to potentially change what you think work is, and maybe empower your freedom, which it has absolutely for me and a lot of my really close loved ones and collaborators. So lay me off or lay off me wound up landing almost spiritually more in line with the collection. But that was the only one that I wound up doing an edit on. And so it has a little bit of a special history with that one.
So everything kind of like started, like in your Web3 kind of like journey, started because of this Discord and of like Blipmap coming to life.
Blipmap was definitely number one. I had no NFTs. Yeah. I didn't know. I've been in crypto since 2016, 2017. Like, you know, I've had a couple ETH. I wasn't a full degen yet. But come Blipmap. Now, when I submitted the artwork, it was very much like I was excited to be an artist. I was excited to be an artist on a project. And,
no one could have expected.
I had no idea. And I mean, I didn't even understand how any of it worked anyway. So it was really, there was no expectations. And what an amazing turnout, my friend, because for something that you have no idea is going to turn out, and, you know, for those of you that are in Blipmap and were there from the beginning, like, it wasn't like some sort of an immediate blockbuster success.
No,
I mean, we sat and enjoyed the creative process of submitting these pieces and then the creative process of watching the community interact with them, see how they would like interact with your own piece and then like hybridize it with your friend's piece, making it a true collaboration between three parties, the two artists and the
community.
This was like the most compelling 2 months of our lives. We were waking up every day looking forward to going to the Discord, looking forward to like hang out with everybody, and we were like becoming a family almost, because every day we were geeking out about all this cool art. And then Blipmap became like successful and interesting for being on chain, and people started giving it more attention, and then the sales started coming in, and then the VC interest, and yada yada yada, and then you know, we know where it all came from there. During the time of Blipmap, you know, getting bigger, I met a lot of great people. I met a lot of new people that I would have never met in tech, in a lot of different fields that I would have never dreamt of crossing paths with, that I'm super grateful for, yourself included. Like, it's been a fantastic way for me to meet people that are working in a sector of design that I don't work in, that their brains kind of work in a different way. They look like at product in a different way. And now I work with some of those people at a day-to-day, and it's amazing because I'm gaining so much knowledge. There's a different side of the coin than I'm. And I also feel like I'm contributing because I am actually also from a different industry.
Yeah, you're part of Web3 history now.
I mean, that's a very nice thing. I mean, I guess sometimes I forget, or maybe I don't appreciate the impact. Like when we had our Blipmap meetup last year, it was really striking how amazingly, it was humbling how sweet everyone was that loves Blipmap, and how actually genuinely excited and interested they were in the artwork. And it was the first time, you know, I've maybe been making art my whole life, but it was actually one of the first times in my life I felt like an artist. Which, I don't know if, it's not sad because it felt amazing. You know, I'll work my whole life and still not think I'm a game developer. Because, you know, when you're an artist, you think you're a piece of shit all the time.
Kind of like imposter syndrome.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how hard you work on something, and it could be your work of labor of love, but when it's out, you'll still think you're a piece of shit. You'll still be like, am I really a game developer? Am I really an artist? But Blipmap really was the first time where I actually felt, wow, one, my pixel art is back in fashion. Holy shit, it's been all these years of me making pixel art and then working in AAA and just knowing that pixel art's not going anywhere because the indie revolution showed me that everyone can make pixel art, but can everyone really make compelling
good pixel art?
Exactly. There's a big difference, and we can get to that in a little bit. That's a whole other conversation. It's the delta between what pixel art is and how easy and accessible it is can be a double-edged sword. But I digress. The point being is, spending all your time working in pixel art to think that maybe it's dead, or like not dead, but like right now it's not lucrative. It's not going to send me to the moon like I was hoping when I was in college. For Web3 to make pixel art suddenly relevant, relative, like financially sound and interesting on a tech side because of on-chain limitations.
Exactly.
Holy shit. What an exciting like merging of all these worlds that I've coincidentally been working towards. It was almost like, okay, this has been me making steps without me knowing to be able to work on this really cool art project that, of course, sent us all to the moon for a little bit. And because I was overlapping with all these great new people, I got to meet people like Midnab and Dozer, which eventually created the Chain Runners. And, you know...
So Chain Runners, for those who don't know, is also kind of like a New York kind of like initiated project in a way. It's kind of like emerged also from New York in a way.
This was definitely born out of the community of Blipmap.
Yeah.
Because there, while out of the five founders currently in Chainrunners, two of them are in New York, the rest are on the West Coast.
Yeah.
But after Blipmap was successful, we were prepping the Blipnaut expansion. And the Blipnaut expansion, I pulled in my longtime illustrator collaborator, Dudu Torres, who I've been working in indie.
He did
all of the covers for all four of my indie games on Steam. We've been working with him. He does all of our conceptual work for games, and he's one of the best character designers I've ever worked with. So shout out to Dudu. But Dudu wound up crushing the Blipnauts, and basically totally Dom and I were producing the Blipnauts for maybe 3 months. Concept art-wise, figuring out their art direction, and then I was basically doing all the liaison work between them, because I was kind of like the producer on that one project. And while creating the Blipnauts, someone had to do the front end and the back end of the website, and those people were Mid and Nav and Dozer. And so I went up doing all the QA for the minting site, because I was super engaged with the Blipnauts at the time, and I was like just living it at that moment. I was like, you know, moonlighting as a Blipmap full-time, like, producer.
And you had set the bar with the Blipmap minting experience.
Oh, yeah.
And then you make the Blipnaut one, which had to be at least as good.
At least, and visually stimulating at the very least, which I think they crushed it. I mean, remember when you hit that mint button and the fucking stars just blasted in your face? That felt amazing. And it felt like another one of those moments in the space where we're like, oh, I've never seen anything like this before at this level of quality. This is so good. Like, it was fantastic. But that was the moment where Mid wound up coming into the Blipmap holders group and pasting Chain Runners and basically going, hey, by the way, check out this other project that I've been working on.
Yeah, just casually, like,
dude, it never
I've been
ends.
Making these awesome things
on the side is like, hey, by the way, I'm just messing around over here while I'm also making the Blipnaut site, designing the Blipnaut site. And, you know, he was, I think he held an Illuminate, but like he was a fan of my my Blipnap pieces, which I guess was very humbling. And but either way, none of us really knew each other. We were just collaborators, and we loved working with each other, and we worked well together. And, you know, we shared feedback really well during the Blipnap launch. So when he posted Chainwonders, I DM'd him immediately. And I was like, hey, dude, I'm sure you have it handled already, but if you need any pixel art, let me know. And he was like, actually, we do, because there's no way we're going to reach our deadline unless we don't, like, accelerate this. So he had kind of wrapped up. He did, like, the foundational work. He did the outline of the humans, the first set of traits, and then I basically went in and extracted all of it and then, like, diversified it.
Yeah, because there's a ton of traits.
There's a ton of traits, and we actually cut a ton of traits as well. There's a lot of really interesting stuff
that
we
were... Exactly.
Just like Lost Blitz, we got our Lost Chainrunners traits. And you may see some of them come in the future, because we have a lot going on with Chainrunners, of course, which we can get to in a little bit. But I just wanted to hit on the fact that, like, Chainrunners and me meeting this team was a result of the Blipnap community being so tight and so organically driven from the beginning, you know, so slow. And that also came from Discord and us being able to gather all of our friends in a single place when the pandemic hit to keep us all vibing together. And if we hadn't done that...
I feel like Discord is the metaverse for now.
It feels like it. Because now it's my job. I wake up in the morning, I'm on Discord every day. It's half of my brain exists on Discord
now. And maybe COVID, in a way, was like this kind of like silver lining of like this spark that kind of like made the whole space explode, because suddenly in 2020, everyone had to lock down. That's also how I came into crypto. It's like suddenly you have this time to reflect, and then you're like trying new things. As an artist, you kind of like you have to create to survive this depressing moment.
Exactly. And I mean, hey, if you have a community of people, they become your audience. And there's nothing better than having an audience of people to send out creative work to get feedback, to get thoughts, to get criticisms, to then get better at what you're doing. And it keeps you sane, it keeps you mentally healthy, it keeps you feeling like you're moving forward, and it keeps you being able to explore what's possible with creativity and creative collaboration. Because again, you're from Europe, I work with people in Southeast Asia, we're working with an illustrator in Brazil, like, and due to, like, you know, Discord's been able to bring us all to a single place to share a single goal, quickly and rapidly, like, share and iterate on our work, and really, like, I don't know. It's doing things that a traditional company can't. We all feel like we're almost a part of a company, but we're really just a community. So it's really exciting, because there's a ton of power there, and we just keep reaping the benefits from it. I feel like we just keep building new things. People come up with a new project. Yeah, you want to collaborate on that? Absolutely.
Yeah, the composability, not just of like different projects working together, but like the composability opened up a lot because of standards, like token standards, and just like NFT, the two different NFT standards that we have now. And then another layer on top of that is Blipnap and other projects like going Creative Commons Zero, which kind of like created those super cool blends of like having a Blipnap cap hat,
chainers, all the derivatives,
hyperloops, like mixing up things from the Chainrunner universe and the Blipnap universe together. How do you see that as an artist, as a game developer also?
It's one of the most compelling parts. And I think, like, when we first got into it, you know, when you're in games, everything is competitive. When you're, especially when you're in AAA, you're not sharing your company's secrets. You're not sharing with, you know, Ubisoft doesn't talk to Epic about what they're doing with their next big game.
Yeah.
Like, Rockstar's not talking to these, like, you know, they're not collaborating with EA on, like, how to make... No, they do not share, and they do not want employees talking to each other. CC0 makes a mockery of that almost entirely. Because what happens is now we're not only working on things that we're passionate about, and we're creative, working closely, trying to really capitalize on each other's strengths as creatives, or as developers, or programmers, or whatever it is, marketers... And we're no longer now stepping on each other, but we're instead like expanding like an amoeba. We're like, here's a seed of an idea, and here's all the tools that you need to work on it. Here's all the inspiration. Here are the colors. Here's your palette. And go crazy. Go wild. And what you give me back, I'm going to now play off of. And we kind of continue this Ouroboros effect of like creation. And we call it like the creative engine, where it's like you're feeding this nebulous blob of human creation power. And it gets you more and more excited about what's around the corner. And it's also created so many great things. Like you said, like the beauty of a thing like OKPC or Hyperloot, these things are a lot of fun because you get to, now we can feature them. But you saw that like Chain Runners, now we love to, we just featured OKPC in our most recent like launch trailer, and Hyperloot and Pills and Blipmap, and to be able to have like a family, it's almost like having a suite. It's like we are, in a way, the CC Zero family is like the multi, it is like the Marvel Cinematic Universe of Web3.
Exactly.
And that's how I want to see it. That's how we should be building. We should be helping each other. We should be having like town halls where we talk about how we're going to properly incentivize our ability to collaborate the best and at our highest maximum efficiency, because ultimately one CC Zero's project success is another one's success if done properly, right? And we've never seen that in games before. So that's the biggest difference. It's like, if you succeed, I succeed, doesn't exist in games, but it does exist in Web3 and specifically in the public domain, which is, you know, it's incredible. Because for me, all I want to do is creatively collaborate. It's like the most, that's like, gives me passion. It makes me wake up in the morning. I want to look you in the eyes and I want to talk about cool shit. And I want to see you smile when we talk about crazy ideas. And then I want to try to fucking figure out how to build it with you. I want to break it down into, you know. And that's producer, creative production is like, it's addicting sometimes. And the one thing that makes it hard is bad motivation or lack of staff, you know, or lack of finances.
From like other people outside.
Exactly. Or people trying to poach or cannibalize. And those are the four things that we almost don't have, where we have them in spades. We have we have the funding if you need it. We have the creative minds. We have the people to do it. Like we have, and we have the platforms. We have the talent. So, and if I don't have the talent, I know someone that does, and they'll likely want to collaborate with me and make something great. So that's been the most exciting and passionate part. Because again, I'm coming from an indie game dev community that's really about collaboration, and there's a lot of strong community in indie game dev, but you never get this level of collaboration. And now I feel like my brain is completely switched over, and I'm a Web3 man now, just bringing as much game industry kind of chops as I can.
Yeah.
See what we can get from it. And with Chain Runners, now that we're moved into the third dimension, I'm no longer pixel arting as much, so it feels nice to go back to my roots and do some pixel art. And I was able to do a really great guest piece for Varley's most recent launch, the Weed Bags of New York, so definitely check that out if you get a chance. But that, it was really great to do some pixel art there, because I've been in Unreal for the last month now. Mm-hmm. And to be back in Unreal 5, basically, we went from creating a 10,000 PFP pixel art on-chain generative project of Chain Runners to doing an amazing like launch with custom views with the 3D avatars, which really was an amazing opportunity that pivoted us in a way that we didn't know that we were going to do that. When we made the Genesis Runners, we didn't think we were moving into 3D. When the opportunity presented itself, we weren't like, oh, we're now going to go conquer the metaverse. But we were like, this is going to be the next best way for us to utilize this art and provide even more value to the token holder of this really cool character. So, for example, my character is 6123. That's the one that I use in my PFP, and I love her. She's like my favorite mint, and I don't know, she kind of reminds me of my wife a bit, and I don't know why I have like that connection. The e-girl hair also is like a hairstyle that I got from my wife, so like there's a little bit of like,
that's cool,
there's a little nepotism there for
me. People identify, that's the kind of like the novel thing as well. It's like not only you have ownership of digital creations, but you identify with them.
I think that relatability with Chain Runners works really great, and I've said this in some of our Twitter spaces, but like Chain Runners worked really well because cyberpunk aesthetic is relatable.
Yeah,
you know it
with the cyberpunk, right? Cryptographic.
It's just not, it's not abstract to people. People get it, and it's also something that they can relate highly to. And then you see the characters, and they're so wide, they're so diverse. They offer so many ways for you to maybe find something that you resonate with, that it does wind up providing you, I would say, one of the more relatable PFP projects. Because granted, we're not all ducks or penguins or lions in real life, so you have the human element, and that's an easy one. But also, everyone in the space is in, I don't want to say they're all in their 30s, but a lot of us are from a similar generation. Grew up with video games. A lot of these people grew up with pixel art, and this is another thing about pixel art, is that pixels never die. Like, there was a moment where I was like, I was worried, oh, you know, is the Web3 space now moving away from pixels? You know, it felt like we're moving into this thing where everyone now has to be 3D. Everything needs to go and be 3D. And it almost feels like
the metaverse has to be pretty.
Yeah, no, I know. And I was like, you know, pixels. I'm just doing pixel art. And I feel like last month pixels came back into style randomly, and now pixels are back. Yeah. So I think pixels have a. When you look at them, they remind you of your past. They remind you of being a kid. They make you feel things that you remember when you were growing up, and that's why they will never die. They kind of come imbued with a magic feeling that comes with a memory that I think is relatable, and it always has an aesthetic please on the eye. So lucky for me, and for people that also have pixel art collections that are successful, will hopefully remain in style aesthetically. They will hopefully remain.
And it has this like kind of like superpower if you combine it with on-chain pixel art, because it's because of the limitation of like the EVM, like all the chains, you cannot restore. I mean, we've seen like with cyber brokers kind of like trying to push what you can store on-chain. But I feel like it stops as like 2D. It's like it's hard to make like fully like detailed 3D characters on chain. Just it's not possible. So it's like kind of has this way to be permanently embedded into this new world.
It becomes like a it's like a relic, and it's from a relic from the past, because it's gonna be these things that we're building now are gonna be around forever. And you know, these are other things that we don't think about from a day to day, but like to think that these things are now have a permanence that will go on forever is crazy. There's a mushroom and there's an eggplant on the chain somewhere that's just gonna be there sitting around collecting dust forever.
Yeah, because with video games, we've seen it like countless times, like game studios shutting down, online game servers shutting down, and people love to play vintage video games, like old video games, like with emulators, or so you have like a ton of games that are either not playable anymore because the servers don't exist and the game wasn't designed for like anyone to prop up private servers.
Yep.
But at least with like on-chain art and like on-chain NFTs, or even just NFTs in general, as long as like the artwork is like on the IPFS or something like that, as long as like people use it, it will stay alive.
Yep.
Which is really different than what was possible to do before.
And luckily it's Ethereum, because I don't think it's going anywhere, at least not anywhere soon. I have a pretty strong belief. I'm a pretty strong, I have a strong conviction around Ethereum.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, again, it's great, and it's great that it's all founded, it's focused around the creative aspect of art and like seeing what you can truly do when limited so much. That's the on-chain stuff for me, the constraints of Blipmap, the constraints of Chainrunners was my favorite part as an artist. I can only work in 32 by 32 or 48 by 48 with four colors. Four colors were fun with Blipmap, I think, and then with Chainrunners, I got seven colors each layer, and there was 11 or 12 layers. So we really, they took the contract and went fucking nuts with it. And it still had some constraints, but it really allowed me to flex my creative like muscles a bit and create some diverse characters. But the important part for pixel art is that it allows you to kind of imagine what it looks like, because it's not going to give you the full picture. Like, you know, like you were saying with 3D earlier, they want this perfectly. I want to be able to see the pores of the character. I want to know their history when I look at their face. Now, you know, pixel art, the other reason why you can identify with it is because your brain tells you what it is. Your brain makes up the story. It fills the gaps in. And then it actually allows you to like self-identify with that character way more. And that's exciting too. That makes you connect even deeper with it. So,
For the Chainrunners, I love how they started to unveil like the 3D versions of them, the XR versions, and then like seeing how certain traits look like in 3D.
Yep.
That was awesome.
Yeah, we had a really amazing time. I mean, I spent a good amount of time doing a lot of great direction on the traits themselves, just to make sure that they look the right way, and like, are they utilizing the right materials? Because you know, suddenly you move into 3D and it's like, oh, is that thing supposed to be a feather, or is it supposed to be a light diode, or like, what is this? Is this a metallic chrome, or is it like a brushed metal? And of course we're getting that ridiculous with the details because we're insane and we have no control over ourselves. We're like, oh yeah, put some scratches on the lens here so it looks like it's been worn because he's taking it off. But that's the fun of realizing something from some, like, you know, when I made a lot of these traits, we didn't think they were going to 3D, like I said. So when you move from 2D to 3D with some of these weird pop culture traits too, you have to think in a brand new way. We're going in the reverse direction from game development. We're going like, well, I guess in Fidelity, we're going the same way in game development, but with game development, you usually start with a prototype and work forward. But this way, we're like creating.
Gameplay first.
Yeah, we kind of like dropped the whole thing, and we said, here are the civilians. And now we're going to start building a... We have to build a world around this. And now we have to make the world make sense about all these choices that we made 7 months ago that we were just having fun. Now we have to, like, make them all make sense, make them cohesive, make a compelling world, and then, of course, create something that everyone can enjoy and, like, have some sort of coherency with.
Yeah.
And the entry into XR, like I said now, I went from working in games by night to working in NFTs by night when I went into Blipmap, and then it was just pixel art, pixel art, pixel art, and I had like a pixel art revolution, and I stopped working on games for a little bit at home. And now that I'm working full-time at Chain Runners, and we've moved into the 3D space, we still have a lot of 2D fun up our sleeves, but I have been so happy, let me tell you, going back into game development, because we're basically... I'm not going to say that we're working on a game, but you saw the Mint experience if you minted an XR, yeah, and we've dabbled with 3D experiences.
We're working some of the videos, yeah.
We're working with space, 3D space, and it's right now we're having a lot of fun. Yeah, it's very early. We're still doing blockout stuff, but we're definitely going to be opening up for early testing. We're going to provide some access to some of our special members in the Discord that were able to get through maybe some of the hack, the Easter egg hack in our Mint process, some of our code breakers. But I will say that, like, moving from a space where I was like, okay, we're going to do Web3 now, and I'm going to move forward and do Web3. I'm leaving games. Because when I took that job, that was my first time in 13 years leaving core games. It was a huge career move for me as far as, like, I am leaving the industry that I spent my whole life kind of only focusing on to now venture forth into this basically massively wide horizon of Web3, which is, like, a catch-all for everything. It's a catch-all for... It's just hard to even wrap your head around. So, of course, that does involve games, but it depends on the company that you're working for. And when I joined Chain Runners, we were still trying to figure out what the next steps were for not only XR, but for the Genesis Collection. And now, because XR landed and has given us these amazing 3D tools and these amazing 3D characters, which actually are, that is the highest production, one of the highest production boundaries in making a game is getting all these assets, all these 3D assets. And the fact that we have all of, like, 40,000 unique models, we can build an entire city if we wanted to.
Yeah.
Like, the environmental structures aren't going to be as painstaking as creating these well-realized models. So being able to now say, hey, I feel like I'm actually making games harder than I was before is amazing. I'm waking up every morning and I'm like, what am I going to prototype next? So this has been fantastic, and I'm really looking forward to, like, getting a lot of you in there to start playing around.
Excited about it as well.
Yeah. Yeah,
and I feel like NFTs are kind of like this new tank that can open up new mechanisms for games, a new, like, cross compatibility between not just like assets, but like more like as even as an indie game studio, you can like release a new game and say, I want to reward with this new game the people that played my last game and like achieved some stuff,
exactly,
have some achievements, and I can just like drop them some like extra skins or extra items, or, you know, like, I can use the same in-game money for, like, various games, and then another studio can also tap into that and use the same currency, or, you know, this whole, even, like, cross-platform in a way. Like, it's platform-agnostic.
Yeah, and we're seeing, like, it's interesting because that is, we're seeing that a little bit with, like, Microsoft Game Pass, or, like, the Epic Game Store, where they own these IPs, and they kind of have a currency that's associated to, like, all those IPs, maybe. But it hasn't taken hold, whereas, like, the CC, especially the CC0 stuff, like, we could, like, Hyperloot and OKPC and Blipmap, and I would love a world in which we're seeing the value from, for example, what I've done in the Blipmap world eventually. You know, in the future Blipmap world, I would love to see that appear in what's going on in my OKPC or what's going on in my chambers. And as long as we're
communicating,
almost like
your, it's kind of like your own on-chain achievement system, or like kind of like your history, like your identity, but also your history as a player.
And it could be from a company level to an individual level. So for me as an artist, I could create something that says, hey, anybody that has an eggplant blip map, you get this in Chain Runners. Mm-hmm. Of course, I don't think I would do that, but the fact that I could on an individual level just incentivize an action that occurs, that's a game mechanic or something, that's amazing, especially because it only hits a certain group of people. So you can suddenly create these like micro pockets of experience based on what the people have done. On a larger sense, imagine if you got a coin based on the amount of time, playtime that you played in like Morrowind or Oblivion, yeah. or like how many hours you played all games on Steam and Steam gave you currency.
I will have a lot of coins.
Oh, dude, we would have tons of coins. The dream, like, you know, I think there were some jokes going around about, which almost made a little bit of sense, whereas if Elon Musk bought Twitter, imagine if, like, the amount of tweets that you've made was converted into Dogecoin or some shit, and you were able to gain some sort of value from your interaction with the platform. At least we could, that's the ideal
making
scenario.
Making shit posters, which...
Yeah.
overnight.
Exactly. And well, hey, I mean... To be fair, this space, there's you know, we have degens of all likes, right? Yeah. So you got Twitter, there would probably be a bunch of shitposters making a good amount of money. Mm. But hopefully there'd be some, you know, intentional tweeters out there as well. At least in Web3, you could see, hey, I've invested this much money in interacting with this platform, and but that was during the Genesis years, and now you're three expansions beyond and you're releasing these things, what do I get? And that's, as a developer, that's what we're thinking about all the time.
Yeah.
We think about every step of the way that we've brought you with Chainrunners, and we're going, well, I can speak for Chainrunners at this in this angle, and say, okay, there's people that have minted Genesis, there's people that were there for this mint, there's people that actually interacted with this POAP, and they were there for this event. How do we create little Easter eggs for all these people that give them value, so they feel like they're gaining something for being present? For being, you know, interacting with our ecosystem.
It doesn't have to have a monetary value. That's a lot of people, like especially gamers and like some like game studios are like kind of like criticizing NFTs because they look at it as a speculative like tool or like as a, they're afraid that everything will become like a play to earn, where I see it more as a extra layer of like compatibility between different platforms and games, and as a creative tool mostly, and it doesn't have to have any value.
Exactly, I think that's the big misconception right now, especially with games, and you'll see this in the games industry right now. There's a lot of vitriol towards Web3 because of the same article that you've read a million times, where like the oceans are being dried up by Bitcoin miners. Like, okay, everybody, like, we get it. You know, we've heard this before, but I think disconnecting the financial gain or like the investor degen madness from NFTs and thinking about it as a piece of tech that can allow that interoperability and that communication between platforms, that could be part of the back end of a game. You don't even need to know that it's there.
Exactly.
And you can still, as a consumer, benefit from it because we've now given you some sort of legacy in your game experience, if that's the way that you were to use it. The unfortunate part is that most of the noise from our space comes from finance people that want to make a ton of money and want to pump and dump or whatever it is. And there's a lot of really great things out there. But I think, you know, of course, we just need more time. Like with any new technology, people are going to fucking hate it. You know, people were still trying to sell horses when the T-Model car was being released, you know? They were like, why do you want a car that eats, like, you know, fossil fuels if you could use a horse with true horsepower? It's like, lady, I gotta feed that thing, okay? I'm done with this. This is old technology. We're done. But there were people that were going to war with the car industry for horses, and they were like, this is the only way. But of course, those people had probably a ton of investment in horses, and those people needed to be phased out before there was no more noise about it. And I'm not saying that we're gonna phase out the naysayers, but those people are gonna understand that eventually these technologies are going to be used in such a way that you're not going to even feel them. They're going to be there, and then you're just going to have to accept them. And it's not always going to be about, we're not taking food out of your mouth, we're not trying to take creativity from the game development process, and we're not trying to transform and like shove a play-to-earn mechanic into every single game that we're trying to make, or, you know, interactive experience. And game is a loaded word, right? That's why we tend not to try to use the word, hey, are we making a game? Everyone who says they're making a game in Web3 doesn't know what the fuck they're doing right now. I mean, it's very obvious. So don't use, we're trying not to use the word game, and I do feel like, for me, I do feel like I know what I'm doing, actually, and I still don't want to use the word game until I know and I've proven to myself in this space that this is a viable, you know, it's viable enough to call it a game. Because for me, a game has a lot of weight to it.
Exactly. It's like metaverse.
I hate that word now. Metaverse is dead to me. Okay, consider the metaverse. I want to call it something else. Right now, give me a cool social space that replaces Discord.
Yeah.
Like, if I could take some of the fun shit that we do in Discord and move it into a social space that's low impact and accessible and requires one click to enter, not 16 clicks and a full, you know, that's fantastic. But the metaverse and competing for the metaverse and seeing what's going on, it exhausts me because I feel like we've been seeing this in games for a while. We've all seen Second Life. Yeah. A lot of people are, again, back to what we were saying, trying to say, oh, they're just trying to put play to earn into Second Life, and they just want to...
No, it's not about that.
Yeah, we're just exploring new possibilities, and we're exploring a new community of players. These are a bunch of players. Some of these people haven't been in game space. So, like, we're also interacting in a new social experiment space where everything feels like a social experiment. We're going to send things out to the community, see how they react to it, and then we're going to iterate based on that. And what you don't get to do in games is iterate rapidly, because you have to launch and complete a $60 million box product, and then you just drop it, and what the consumer gets is what they get. But what we have is the benefit of slow, iterative, community-driven creation. And as we give you guys, we're going to give you guys, you know, we can give you a cue, and you hit us back with a cue, and then that changes the way that we develop. And it was like that with early Blipmap. It was like that. It's been like that with Chainrunners, and it feels like that's the only way to go, and it's the most compelling way to build.
It's like
early access on Steam for indies, except you don't have to deal with all the angry Steam commenters. You actually have a community of people that are invested in the space. They're like, it's like a new way to kickstart, except you get to build this thing together.
Yeah.
And you're building it with confidence. I know that if I give you something and you don't like it, and you tell me you don't like it, I'll change it. And then next time I give it to you, if you smile, I keep going down that direction. Mm-hmm. And that's going to create a well-polished, well-realized, honed product that the community wants and that you can be proud of. So in that way, I almost feel like if you are dedicated to that sort of path and that development cycle, there's no way you can lose. You have a high integrity. You want to give the people what they want. You want to be creative. You want to create new things. You want to subvert expectations. And you want to bring people along for the ride and make them feel like they're a part of it.
Yeah.
And I feel like as long as you do that, and that is my favorite part about Web3, to say that, like, that has been my favorite part, is that, like, I can involve you. I don't have to feel like I'm giving up the keys to my kingdom because I have to keep all my secrets because you're going to steal my ideas. No, I want to bring everybody into the creative fray. I want to build alongside you because it's going to lead us to success, because it won't lead us to failure, because it's what you want, right? You tell us what you want, and we're going to build it together. So that's been really satisfying, and it's been a complete game changer, and it has completely changed the creative pipeline for us. And I think that's my favorite takeaway, honestly.
Yeah, and also you kind of like have this standard that everyone can use, which is like agnostic of which platform you're going to play the game on and which like marketplace.
And I guess that's where you get that Marvel Cinematic Universe feel from, because everybody has to kind of, everyone's using the same foundation.
Yeah.
So that means that eventually anyone can say, hey, you want to work on this thing? I can plug mine into yours, and we can build something new with it. Mm-hmm. So that's it's so odd. It's so new. It's crazy. You ever play Sonic and Knuckles on the Genesis?
No.
Okay, Sonic and Knuckles was a cartridge, right, of course? And the cartridge had a flappy top, and you could plug Sonic 2 or Sonic 3 into it.
Okay.
And it was one of the few times, like a game genie, where you were able to take one game and plug it into another game, and they would communicate with one another and share data.
Yeah.
So you'd be able to play as Knuckles in Sonic 2, which was mind-bending as a kid, because you play Sonic 2 and there was no Knuckles. How is there Knuckles in Sonic 2 suddenly? How did they get the sprite of Knuckles into the game of Sonic 2? But they made the game of Sonic 2. It was released as a full package. And that felt like composability. It felt like they were communicating. And that's what we're doing here. That's Web3. We're Sonic and Knuckles.
I saw like a bit similar, but like with this game, Stray, where you play as a stray cat.
Yep. Yeah.
Like immediately had people like creating like models and skins like to replace a cat. Some people, I think, used like Sonic or like this.
Stop,
I don't remember the name. The purple dragon. What's his name again? From Spyro.
Oh, Spyro. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, as the cat.
So you can play as Spyro. So I feel like Web3, in a way, it was already possible like to create mods and like skins and like even kind of like sell them.
Yep.
But there is no centralized kind of like, not centralized, but like no way to easily market what you do as a modder.
Yep. Because usually it's not something that you're supposed to be making money
on.
Like there's tons of Counter-Strike modders that like aren't supposed to be selling skins but make a ton of money on it. And there's been a lot of like ecosystems that are hidden from the plain sight because they aren't allowed to do the things that we can now start doing in Web3. The only thing here that I will say is, until we get, like, again, it's just about time. We need to stay in the space, we need to keep building, we need to keep the integrity high. We need to try to be high integrity builders. We need to not just be out there trying to fucking make quick money. And eventually we're going to build the integrity and we're going to get more people from other industries to join us and continue to build more compelling stuff so that we can hopefully get to the point where the modding community of game of the games is now modding for Web3.
Yeah.
And that way the modders on Web3 can actually, that their work will communicate.
Yeah.
Right now the Counter-Strike modders are not communicating with the Warcraft 3 use map settings people. They're putting just as much time into their development. All these people are game developers that just don't know how to use an engine, but know how to reverse engineer, use the like tools in Neverwinter Nights, or you know what I mean? And that's how a lot of game developers scratch that itch. But until, you know, like you said, when that game's done, all their worker is gone, basically. Mm-hmm. When no one plays Counter-Strike anymore, all those maps that you've made, they're going to be gone forever.
Yeah.
In an ideal future, you know, what we're calling Web3 right now, this tech umbrella that'll allow all of our tech to start communicating, imagine a world in 10 years from now where, like, your game and my game, it wouldn't even be a question that we could just collaborate and be like, yo, dude, I'm going to put a secret level in my game that brings me into your game.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be... And this is what you meant earlier about new mechanics and, like, new revolutionary mechanics and ideas that don't have to be tied to financial gain that this sort of tech provides. And, you know, to just put a pin in that, it's going to take time for people to understand that power. And we just need to keep building things that point to that direction and show how cool that shit could be. And then people are going to catch on. This isn't going anywhere. So I'm ready to kind of see where this new industry is going to go.
Yeah, and I'm sure we will see that like embedded in some game engines. You know, like team from Unreal isn't like against Web3 and NFT. So I wouldn't be surprised to see some sort of like Web3 components
in
Unreal 5 or... You know.
Something to make it easy for us to plug into, hopefully in Unreal 5, but it's, again, it's, can we get the devs to value it enough and to legitimize it enough to provide us those tools so that the industry standard can change, and then we can just start building for Web3 without having to convince anybody.
Yeah, because when you blend the two, you can kind of like do super weird thing, like you can have on-chain activity that kind of like modify like the polygon model of your character or the textures can be driven from on-chain data. So it's kind of like, pulling data from the web, which you can already do, but not everything has an API. Not everything has, you have limitations to a lot of APIs. You have to subscribe to some of them. You have to, it's all kind of different way to pull data. There's no cohesion.
So you're either choosing one or the other. You're in Unity or you're in Unreal. You're going to choose like a format and you're going to stick to it. Yeah, I do look forward to the time where one of the big dogs finally just goes, hey, we're going to create tools whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
And then that'll be it. Then it'll probably start just revolutionizing from there and we'll be able to start accelerating. And I already feel like we're accelerating, but you know, whether or not the market is what it is, like for us, it's been exciting to not have it be a crazy hype-driven like whirlwind for just a little bit. Granted, sure, nobody likes it.
It's kind of like being decorrelated from the crypto.
And in a way, like, of course, nobody likes the discomfort of a market crashing, but the whole world's market's crashing. So it's not like we're just on an island here. And as a builder in this space, I get to appreciate a lull where everyone can just kind of shut up a bit and we can actually work
kind of
on filters a product.
Filters out the noise. And like the grifters in the space.
Yeah, and then suddenly we can work on something for 4 or 5 months, which is like, you know, you need time to develop something compelling. It can't just be about the 1 week turnaround airdrop that's just going to build hype and try to make speculation. Like, that meta, at least for right now, is over. It may return, but what's nice is there'll be a weeding out of people maybe that aren't as serious about the space during this phase. I think we're seeing it already. And we're just gonna continue to hunker down and build cool shit, and hopefully we come out, we know we'll come out the other side with something cool.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It's like the internet, it's like, you cannot really stop it. It's a force that's out there and like evolving. And like you said with the Amoeba, it's like, it's very organic.
Exactly. It's like the blob.
Yeah.
It's the creep. Blob. The creep is creeping and it's not going to stop. You can't stop it. We let it out of the bottle. And now I'm converted. You know, we're slowly converting people. So the more people that convert over and understand and can use their skills from their industry to help motivate ours and like create amazing, better packages that are way more intentional and way more quality and polished and well realized, it's just going to... bring more and more legitimacy to the space, and we're just going to continue to fly.
Yeah, and also like this kind of like being able to own things, even if they're digital.
I think that's going to be important. Yeah, and again, for people that love games, that's been a dream.
Yeah,
I've always wanted to own my blade, and you don't have the sword that I have.
Yeah,
that's amazing.
It's a bit like coming full circle. Like before, you had those games, like had like a box and a booklet and everything, and you didn't have DLC. You couldn't really upgrade the game.
Yep.
So you had this physical object that was like yours,
and that was
it. And then it's all digital, and then you have DLCs and upgrades and everything. But now you can own this digital.
Yep, and in a way, I mean, like, yeah, it's kind of redefined. Downloadable content and microtransactions are completely redefined in this space,
yeah,
too. So that also is a different lever that kind of changes the way that you approach expanded content over time. And that's, I mean, again, back to the game development, like, parallel is, and the way that the Web3 development pipeline has changed it is, you don't even think about the DLC. Every day is like DLC. Like, you don't have to develop the whole package. So because we're giving you small bits of content that are slowly becoming cohesive over time, and in an iterative fashion, you never have to worry about, oh fuck, we did 90%, and now we have to figure out how to create DLC that kind of brings it all together at the end, or provides the value that we may have missed because, oh, it fell flat when we launched and people were hoping for this. Yeah, no, that's all out the window. Now you can actually build something over time that there is no need for DLC, because you can choose to get the mint done this month, because next month there'll be this thing, and maybe you're more interested in this package. So it also gives a ton of flexibility to the consumer as well, which is what we all want. I don't want some of the things in the game I don't care about. Some of the content that they release, I don't want to have to pay for. So also being able to a la carte content this way is really nice. So again, it's accessibility is key. I think that is what will ultimately win in the end.
And I feel like also for artists to either like sell their work or like make a living out of what they create, it creates this kind of like new platform to...
It's been a game changer for normal artists, I think. I think there's more artists that were starving that are no longer starving and have fundamentally changed their lives on the back of truly intentional and genuine work. I mean, there's a ton of people out there that have been doing great artwork for years and being paid nothing for it, that just had 1 month foray in the last 12 months with Web3, released their artwork, and are now like, holy shit, I can actually be an artist. There's no more starving artists. There's no more of this like fiction that we heard our whole lives where you can't be an artist because you aren't going to be hired to do that. And there's just so many concept artists in this world. You can't, you know. But this actually changed it for me. And maybe that is back to what I said at the beginning of the interview. That's what made me feel like a real artist, because for the first time, I made more money on my art than I did in 12 years of making indie games.
Yeah.
And indie games were my passion. And I was living and breathing them. And you know, you're not making them because you want to make money. And I wasn't making the art because I wanted to make money. But to accidentally almost make that sort of financial
really cool.
change in my life off a piece of art was the most incredible moment. You know, what a beautiful moment. And it unlocked so much more creation for me. And it unlocked so many more creative projects for all of us that were a part of it. Now all we want to do is keep creating. It's the dream. It's so motivating. Yeah. So it's been life changing. And
I'm really cool.
I'm in a happier place now. I'm probably in one of the best places of my life now, and it's because of that flexibility and that freedom and the community and the love and the genuine nature of the creative space. So I'm very thankful to be here.
Thanks a lot for taking the time to do this interview.
Dude, absolutely. Thank you for the time. It's been great talking to you.